Hey folks, Jared here. It's a big Navy week here at SimSec. Thursday morning, we rolled out Bryans, Clark, and McGrath discussing the Navy's force generation model. Today, we have Walker Mills in the host chair, and he's interviewing the legend, Professor Milan Vigo of the elite U.S. Naval War College. This episode was edited and produced by David Sahita. We just launched the call for submissions for the SimSec forum for authors and readers over at the main website. There is a particular piece that you enjoyed this year, nominate it, and if it gets enough votes, you can hear the author present his or her work. We've also officially put out our call for articles for the end of year fiction contest. Go over to simsec.org for full details. Finally, I want to take the opportunity to recommend our partners in the SimSec podcast network, the Bilge Pumps. You can find Alex, Jamie, Drac, and a pile of Iron Brew bottles wherever you download your podcasts. On that note, I'll turn it over to Kim Bruceman.
You're listening to Sea Control, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security.
Welcome back aboard the Sea Control podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today we're talking with Dr. Milan Vigo, a professor of operations and the R.K. Turner Professor of Operational Art at the Naval War College. Milan is the author of 15 books and over 380 articles. But most recently, Operational Warfare at Sea, Theory and Practice, Exercising Control of the Sea, Theory and Practice, Maritime Strategy, and Sea Denial, Theory and Practice. We're excited to have him on the podcast today, and we're going to be talking about the complex nature of naval operations. And this is we're excited because this is his first podcast. Milan, welcome aboard. Do you want to add anything else to your introduction?
I'm very happy to participate in your program. That's my first time on podcast, and hopefully everything will be okay. I really don't have anything. I'm here at the college since 91, and I think we've been out 30 years this year. And before that, I worked at Defense Intelligence College. I was teaching East European Studies and Soviet Naval Operational Art, and then also I took part as a part of team on wargaming for the Red Side at NDU, National Defense University. And I came to the country as a political refugee in 1976 and then stayed here.
Before we start, I'd like to remind our listeners that the opinions presented here are solely our own and should not be taken as representative of any of the institutions that we are associated with. I want to start by asking you kind of how your books fit together. You were describing it a little bit to me before we started the podcast, but you're publishing a lot. So how do these books fit together?
My focus was since I came to the college here, I started to teach Soviet Naval Operational Art at the DIA. And then I transferred that concept, or the operational art, not Soviet, but in generic, to elective here. And I developed this as an elective in 92 actually. And then 2 years later, I decided to propose to my chairman and my faculty to establish full course or resident program on operational art. And that happened in 94. And since then, we are actually teaching operational art as a core curriculum on the military theory. And then later, after 2006, that was expanded when we got permission to novelize the resident program for junior course to the naval operational art or maritime operational warfare. So since 2006, we are teaching that, and we expanded most of my writings actually in that course, and also the course on the joint operational warfare. So that's a background for these books, you know, and then for the last 10, 11 years, I have been publishing mostly books on the operational warfare at sea. And I just finished last year, the fourth volume. They're not called volumes, but the first one is Operational Warfare at Sea, which is Foundation, and then Maritime Strategy and Sea Control, then Sea Denial, and then Exercising Control of the Sea. So that's a four-volume series on the Operational Warfare at Sea. And before that, in 2003, I published one book, a textbook here on Operational Warfare, and then it was expanded in 2007 to Joint Operational Warfare, which is a 1,500 pages textbook, and that's a main source for readings, you know, in our course, you know, on operational art, actually. Okay, so now I've shifted my attention to tactics, and I published General Naval Tactics by Naval Institute in 2021, and I'm now working on the sequel, which is the Tactics of Naval Combat Arms, you know, Surface Forces, Submarine Forces, Naval Aviation, and this and that. So that's what my, for the next two or three years, I tried to complete about, I think, four books on naval tactics, you know. So that's how I plan to do it.
Is it fair to say that these books mirror pretty closely what you're teaching at the Naval War College?
All these books are taught here. They're not the entire, you know, content, but most of the reading, especially a book which is very popular, is Operation Warfare at Sea, second edition, 2018. Is used really as throughout the maritime operational warfare. But we don't have enough hours to teach everything, but faculty has all the books, you know, and they all study this, you know, so it's been, you know, in other words, whatever I write is really in, my aim is to improve curriculum. It's not disconnected from our curriculum, okay? And I've been very blessed, you know, to have a great support from my bosses. They let me to do most of writing for the last 6-7 years. And I teach or reduce, you know, I teach only about 10-15 sessions, you know, for each trimester. And all out of my time is really devoted to writing, okay. And I finish also two historical monographs, if you know. One is a major fleet versus fleet operations in the Pacific War, and that deals with the Battle of Coral Sea, Battle of Midway, and the Philippine Sea. That was published in 2016. And this year we will publish major naval operations in European waters, 1939-1945, which is study also three major naval operations, you know. One is a PQ-17 convoy in July 1942, then Pedestal, Operation Pedestal to Malta in 1942, and then landing in Anzio in January 1944. So that's now the whole complete, these two historical monographs and four books is dealing all with operational art. Let's see.
Milan, I also want to ask, in the beginning of Maritime Strategy and Sea Denial from 2018, you mentioned that there's a gap in the literature that you're trying to fill. And can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, do you think that there's a space that you're trying to fill with these books?
Well, in my mind, you know, I think there's again, there are a lot of articles written, but I think there are not many substantive works, you know, in English language on operational art at sea, operational warfare at sea, and also operational art in general. And theories are actually neglected, I think, and the reasons are many, and not the best person to diagnose this, you know. But I think one reason why people shy from theory, I think, because they... especially naval officers, you know, they somehow consider theory is somehow abstract. It's really for professors. It's not for them. But I think reason because I think misunderstanding that theory is essentially experience is based on experience of the past wars. And the way the theory is developed is different than theory or chemistry or physics, where you have hypotheses and then you test hypotheses, they become theory. Here you have experience and then you derive certain lessons, you know, and then that becomes part of the theory. And we always say that anytime theory conflicts with reality must yield to reality. So it's a constant, and I think there is nothing, you know, theory, good theory should be always general, it should be flexible, and that search for the improvement theory, it never stops, you know. So that's how I think that very few works, you know, done on in various aspects of the operational warfare sea, especially in terms of major naval operations. We have done a lot of good things in practice in World War II, but after that, it was that area had been neglected, you know.
When I read your work, I'm always struck by the amount of history that you bring to bear on the reader. You know, it seems like on the same page, you know, we can have an example from the Punic Wars, an example from World War I, World War II, the Pacific, Europe. And so I really appreciate that. And I think a lot of it's history also that we may not be familiar with, because a lot of it's European history. And I also want to ask, Milan, you know, you mentioned you thought there was kind of a paucity of sources in English. Are you turning to other international places to pull from?
I was fortunate. After the collapse of Soviet Union, I went to Berlin, and there is one library or Bundeswehr library which collected all the textbooks and doctrinal documents from the former East German Navy and Army from Dresden, and that was moved to Berlin. And I was able to get copies of all these documents. And so I think I'm very familiar with what the Soviets had done, you know, during the Cold War, but also in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were many of the works which were previously classified, and they were published in 1940s and 1930s on operational art. I got all of them. So their theory, I think that the Soviets had much better or much more systematic approach to study operational art. But I think the problem with them is a command and control, you know, and a very rigid society. And that's a reflection also on the military. So the practice was always behind the theory. Theory was far ahead of their practical ability to execute that. The Germans were just different. They had a lot of work done, you know, but I think they were not, to my surprise, a little systematic as the Soviets were in 1930s, you know. But they had a better concept in practice, you know, because of mission command and many other. I always say that Germans lost wars, yeah, but they have been unique, you know, in focusing on war fighting and leadership, which other armies and navies had neglected, you know, in my judgment, you know.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that because normally we think of the German military influencing kind of ground combat and ground tactics, and certainly we see some of their doctrine reflected in the U.S. Army and the Marine Corps. You know, I wasn't aware that it was so that it had the same kind of effect at sea.
Well, you know, they have weaknesses in always in policy. Policy strategy has been really, in my judgment, has been always pretty bad. You know, there was disconnect between policy strategy and operational realities. And yes, they won many campaigns and many major operations. In the end, they won the war because of the you know huge flaws at the strategic and policy level. And I think one reason for that was the legacy of Moltke, the senior, the field marshal. Idea was that once the war starts, there is no place for policy and strategy. Then you had to turn into you know what military thinks. You know, I think that's a basic problem with them. You know, in the way they conduct warfare, especially World War One, and in World War Two, you know, it was Hitler, you know, and his interference and so on. But I have been great admiring the way the training, education. I think we can borrow a lot of things. I think we can also more faithfully apply mission command or the way they actually did, you know. So there is a lot of things we can borrow, you know, and emulate, you know. But there are certain things they were not that good, you know.
Milan, do you think that there is in the U.S. Navy's kind of doctrine and theory today influences from Soviet naval theory and German naval theory?
No, I don't think they adopted the Soviet theory. I think, you know, the way when we revived the interest in operational art, there were a group of people in the Fort Leavenworth and they studied the Soviet, there was one office called Soviet Studies, Military Studies Office. And they gave a major input when the Army developed airland battle concept, you know, and also the FM-100-5 operations. So the term operational art was borrowed actually from the Soviet theory, from Svechin. And I think also the studies of the Yom Kippur War was major also influence on our development of the flying operational art in 1980s and others. My personal view that U.S. Navy really don't understand sea control, for example. There's a lot of people still believe that sea control somehow is identical to naval presence. You know, the virtue that we have a big presence in Western Pacific or Mediterranean, for example, that you have some sea control. No, nobody has sea control in peacetime. Sea control is a concept which is applicable only once the war starts. And what we talk in peacetime is what we call naval influence. And naval influence is combination of your naval combat potential and also perceptions of the friends and enemies and neutrals about your naval strength. And that not necessarily is not identical to your naval combat potential. So there are many psychological elements there too, you know. We don't have, I think, you know, a good understanding of sea control. And I will also go over and say that too much emphasis is on sea control versus sea denial. And we have neglected that, you know. And sea denial is a viable concept. We apply sea denial in 1941-42 after Pearl Harbor to the landing at the Guadalcanal. And our fast carriers and submarines were offensively used against the, you know, someone is against the maritime traffic, fast carriers against strong points in Central Pacific and Southern Pacific. And then we went on to offensive, you know, in August 1942. Today, for example, we might be, you know, in a situation, if we have a hypothetically war with China, that China is closely aligned with Russia. So Russia and China cannot force us to be strategically on defensive initial phase of the war. And that's what I had problem with, these concepts of area denial, anti-axis, you know, because it always assume that, let's say, China will be somehow on defensive and we will be on offensive. And I would say that probably not true. Probably will be both sides will go on offensive. And then after a certain time, one side or another will be forced to go strategically on defensive. I think the reason is also psychological, because we don't think about sea denial. And sea denial has a different methods of how to achieve it than sea control. So we have to be educated and trained to do both things. Or, for example, if you have a simultaneous crisis in the, let's say, the Western Pacific, Korean Peninsula, or Taiwan, or in Persian Gulf, you don't have sufficient forces, so you might be forced to be on sea denial in one area and be on sea control in another area. So I think that's one of the great, for me, the concerns, you know, that the Navy doesn't think that way, I think.
And so that's a great segue, Milan, because I do want to ask about your book, Sea Denial. Yeah, you know, as a Marine, that's an interesting topic for me and one that's kind of a hot topic. So can you talk a little bit more about the methods for sea denial that you talk about in your book?
Well, there are several methods. You know, one is what we call traditionally said avoiding decisive encounter with the enemy fleet. You know, it's called fleeting being. The other one is weakening enemy forces over time. Then also if the other Navy declared blockade, then is also naval blockade. Sea denial also have more focus on destroying the enemy military economic potential of maritime trade versus defensive protection of trade, which is more concern for the superior side. So these are main methods, you know, which we can apply, you know. Now, offensively minded Navy might actually go operationally also on offensive. If we are strategically on defensive, medium Navy or small Navy should be tactically on offensive, but operationally probably be also on defensive because it doesn't have sufficient forces to do anything at operational level. But I think for our Navy, it's a stronger Navy, we should be tactically and operationally on offensive and strategically on defensive, but not permanently, but you know, temporarily. And I'll give you one example. The weaker side was operational on offensive. That was Japanese Navy, because Japanese Navy, like U.S. Navy, Royal Navy, was offensively minded. Battle of the Philippine Sea, they went on offensive to prevent our land and to destroy our forces, you know, covering the landing in Marianas. And then also Leyte, they were strategically on defensive, but operationally they were on offensive because they were seeking a decisive battle. So that's one thing which is different. I think traditional naval, you know, the naval thinkers, you know, they always focus on fleeting being, but there are also some exceptions that you might conduct or also seek a decisive encounter if you are offensively minded, you know.
One of the things that I want to ask about, you know, being a Marine is you talk some about the way that land forces and land-based forces can kind of have an impact on sea denial or contribute to it. Can you talk a little bit about how you would, if you were, you know, a land force or a weaker state, that you would, what methods you would use to undertake sea denial?
But, you know, there are various, in the history shows many examples, you know, land forces were on offensive on land, you know, but because of weakness of the naval forces, they were strategically on defensive at sea and vice versa. You know, ideally, both land forces and naval forces should be on offensive. For example, in the Korean War, before the what Marines called, you know, withdrawal from Hungnam in 1950, we were strategically on defensive, but we were on land, but we were strategically on offensive at sea. So that in a littoral area, that's a lot of variants which can actually complicate the things in terms, you know, of planning execution. you know, I always say that the navies and the army, I mean, the air force and so on, certainly they are always complementing the ground forces. Ground forces are always the most important because the outcome of war is always on land. That's where the people live. Navy and the Air Force can, I mean, greatly contribute to that, but they're always supporting arms, you know.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And so you brought up the littoral, and I want to kind of ask, you know, before we get into the littoral, how do you conceptualize it or define it? Because I know you also use terms enclosed sea or narrow seas, and sometimes I think it gets confused for
you
us.
Know, littorals, I think, is a too broad and too imprecise term, you know, because it encompasses lot of areas. For example, open waters fronting the East Coast, West Coast, United States, or Latin America, that's littoral too. And then you have peripheral seas like a South China Sea or East China Sea. And then you have archipelagos like Indonesian archipelago or Solomon's archipelago. And then you have enclosed seas, which means the seas which has a single exit to the larger sea or ocean, or semi-enclosed like a North Sea, which has a two exits. So I would say that narrow seas really apply. My most complicated picture is really in a enclosed seas like a Persian Gulf or North Sea, you know, as a semi-enclosed sea. So these are collectively called narrow seas. And that term came to use, you know, in medieval era, you know, in during the wars between France and England, and pertained to English Channel, especially Strait of Dover. And then that term was revived in World War II to the small actions, you know, in the English Channel, you know, North Sea and so on in the Mediterranean. So, but, you know, I think when we talk about littorals, we have to make distinction that which area we are talking, because each of these areas poses different challenges and different opportunities, you know.
What makes operations different? I mean, obviously the terrain is different when you're talking about the littoral or enclosed seas.
Different is enormous influence on land. And you have a smaller, among other things, small size, short distances offer much greater opportunities to the weaker side to properly integrate its naval and land air capabilities in order to oppose you. And your forces essentially operate within the envelope of the defender. And I would say that, you know, during this, you know, heyday or transformation, the proponents of network-centric warfare were advocating that NCW allows you geographically separated forces to act properly and so on. But that doesn't apply in narrow seas because you are geographically constrained. You know, you are operating in a very small area, so you cannot be dispersed, you know. Another thing, you are always exposed to the almost continuous surveillance, okay? There is also enormous influence on mind warfare. Mind area or suspected of mines will have the same effect as it is land. In other words, the mines actually can change geography, and so you have to avoid that area whether the mines are really there or they are suspected to be in certain areas. So there is room for maneuver, or your forces are much, much more constrained. Then I think I would say that warning times, you know, and the surprise and high intensity actions is much more higher in a narrow seas than it is on the open ocean set. And then you have a constant threat from the air. Without a strong air cover, you cannot possibly operate today. And I would say also we need also different platforms. And the fact that some ships which are much bigger can operate, you know, that doesn't mean you should use a bigger platform which are high costly, highly capable, but by high cost. They need also to have a different and more balanced navy to operate in the narrow seas, you know. This kind of ships should be always covered from distance with much more powerful forces like a carrier strike groups and all land-based air or what.
Milan, I want to kind of pull the thread a little bit there on the Navy composition. Do you think the U.S. Navy is appropriately sized or equipped for kind of littoral combat?
I don't think it's balanced. I think, you know, some people will say, well, we don't need smaller ships, you know, because you are blue water Navy and we can rely on allies. But I'm not sure that we can allow, you know, that we can actually rely on allies. You need your own capabilities, you know, and I think is any time you have a war, it was always shortage of smaller ships, always, especially for the defense protection of the shipping. And we don't have it. And that cannot be somehow that helicopters or land-based air are going to protect your ships. You need still these naval platforms, you know.
We don't have
a balanced Navy, in my judgment. We need to balance the Navy, you know.
And I do want to ask, Milan, also about amphibious operations.
Yeah.
You know, and if you think there's a lot of arguments going around about whether or not it's still possible to do kind of forcible entry operations or amphibious operations in the modern era. And you know, thinking about the way that you think about the littorals, do you think it's still possible to do the kind of classical?
Well, I know there is a lot of discussion. I remember, and I have a high admiration for Robert Gates, you know, former Secretary of Defense. I think he was somehow doubting that in this new era, when you have a great increased area denial, anti-access capabilities, whether we can do still amphibious assault. And I would say, yes, the methods had to be different than what we had in the past, but it's really ahistorical. I mean, to think that you don't need amphibious landings, you know, throughout the history, the naval power must always go ashore. And it's not going by firing tomahawks, you know, or bombing and so on. You need to have troops on the ground. So what always changed was the method. You remember, you know, the reading that in the aftermath of Gallipoli fiasco in 1915, the British came to a conclusion that in the era of coastal defenses and aircraft, the large-scale landings were not possible. But our Marines, you know, based on the fleet exercises, you know, a study of the German landing in Bay of Riga, Operation Albion in October 1917, they came to different conclusion. And in 1934, we have landing manual, and that landing manual paved the way to the fleet training publication, and we applied that, you know, with great success in World War II. In the aftermath of the war, Omar Bradley, General Omar Bradley, who was chief of Joint Staff, he expressed the view, you know, a year before Incheon, that era of large-scale landing was over. Well, then we have Incheon, 15 September 1950, with 70,000 UN troops, you know, highly successful. Any view that, in my judgment, is premature to say that amphibious landings are obsolete and you cannot do it. New creative methods must be found. That's a different.
And what about, Milan, kind of the other side, the coastal defense? How would you think about coastal defense, or what would you propose are the most effective ways of defending against an amphibious landing?
Well, you need, I would say that certainly multi-layered. You have what you call a seaward defense zone, and then you have a coastal defense zone, you have a rear defense zone. I think must be always focused on I mean, in terms of organization or the joint force commander. The coastal defense is also one partly integral part of what we call operational protection in the maritime theater. So when you talk about seaward defense zone, you need defense, certainly air defense, you know, anti-combat craft defense, anti-submarine, the defense of the maritime traffic, anti-terrorism, and anti-commando raid defense, but has to be all integrated. The only way to do that is that having the theater commander to organize all these things, you know. So,
no, I think that's an interesting point, and I think that's something that the Marine Corps right now is kind of working on is how to integrate in terms of command and control with the Navy for their EABO concept.
Well, you know, the defense or naval defense, coastal defense in itself, you know, is really in many ways linked to the sea control. Because if you have a defense which is very effective on the coast, you extend actually the effectiveness, or you reinforce effectiveness of your sea control or control that area. And without coastal defense, you cannot. There is one concept we which we don't use it, but the Russians use, the Soviets, they call operational favorable regime in the coastal waters. That means for the Navy to properly employ forces, you need to organize naval side of defense of the coast. You know, that means to secure basing and deployment area. And without strong coastal defense, then naval forces cannot operate. So that's a mutually supporting whatever Marines or Army do. You know, they also, the Navy is deeply also involved and certainly affected. You know,
I've always thought that that the Soviet example is a really interesting case, because in the United States we don't really have that history of at least in recent history, being, you know, guarding our own coast. It's usually a power projection type scenario.
Yeah, yeah. Not everything is applicable to us, you know, certainly, you know, but I think we had tradition always great superiority in terms of human element, you know, the commanders and staffs and our non-commissioned officers, you know, and also the petty officers and so on. That's a great, the Soviets never had it, you know. They are very weak on that. And I wish we never become so bureaucratized that we are not effective. You know, we need to really faithfully apply mission command. And mission command to be properly applied means zero error tolerance must go away. Because if you don't have a tolerance for errors or your subordinates, you possibly cannot have a successful mission command concept.
How would you train to imbue mission command, or what would you emphasize in training and education for naval officers?
Well, there are many, you know what, the superficially mission command is easy, okay, but it's not what we consider many people, because the centralized control, decentralized execution, that's a mantra. It requires a lot of things. Among many things, it requires understanding of the true nature of war. The war cannot be considered as complexity theory or, you know, systems theory. It is a Clausewitzian teaching of war. And that means the war is full of uncertainty and chance and luck and irrationality. And so that's a first requirement to apply the mission command. And then mission command must be properly based, that commanders are highly educated and also highly educated subordinate commanders. Because if you don't have a highly educated personnel, then you have to rely on directive orders. You cannot have a commander's intent. And commander's intent must be properly formulated and articulated. And so another thing is also that I think very important thing is that the relationship between higher command and subordinate must be excellent, that there is a mutual trust. And if you have what we call micromanagement, you know, bypassing subordinates, you know, you are not going to be effective in mission command. So education and training and a sound doctrine and the proper application of the commander's intent and, as I said, the proper understanding of the true nature of war. So there are many things which has to fit, you know, okay? And I'm not saying that the mission command can be applied in all situations. You know, there are situations, for example, where errors on the part of subordinates are endangering mission or the commander as a whole or adjacent commander, then commander has the duty to overrule. And I think another thing, very important thing, that errors made in good faith should not be punished. Otherwise, you are going to inhibit initiative on the part of the commander. That's what was such a problem for the Soviet armed forces, where there was a habit of waiting on orders because of fear if they commit the made mistake, you know, they're going to pay not only with their rank, but also with their life, you know. And so we need to go away from that. I think we have been very good, you know, in pre-war years, you know, and when you look, you know, Admiral Nimitz, Admiral King, Admiral Spruance, they are all people who are not micromanaging the subordinates. They have a great trust in subordinate commanders, you know, and it was very effective. So we can go back to that. But I think it will take a long time, you know, because we have now for many, many years, you know, these deeply ingrained things, you know, I don't think they're conducive, you know, to the proper application of the mission command.
I think that's fascinating that, you know, that your emphasis on education as a prerequisite for mission command. And I would ask you now that, you know, as a as a professor at the Naval War College, do you think that the education that education, we have in the Navy is sufficient?
When you look at our doctrine, there is almost no step, for example, in a mission commander's estimate or any others, where we don't talk about risk. That's a terrible thing. It's going to inhibit. There's too much focus on risk. We already, when you look, you know, when we develop course of action, we have already steps where we had to test each course of action. And one is actually whether is what risk factor came into play. But there is no need in every doc, everywhere. Now they included even in commander's intent to have a risk. Well, when you put risk in commander's intent, you are essentially really watering down your intent because you are too overly concerned with the things which might badly happen. But what is also forgotten, risk is also an opportunity. If you take sometimes prudent and high risk, you are going to have also gain. So risk is not only source of danger, but also an opportunity.
That's really interesting.
No, I'm saying, no, seriously, we really don't understand the true meaning of the mission command. We use these buzzwords, you know, and we don't really, the mission command require a lot of things to be in place in order to be effective.
Are there any really good examples of mission command, either in international navies or in U.S. history? I know you use some World War II examples, but maybe something
Admiral
more
Nelson.
Recent?
Admiral Nelson was a great practitioner of the mission command. No, I'm serious. Admiral Spruance, Admiral Halsey, Admiral King, they were all good. General MacArthur, do you know that General MacArthur was at the headquarters on Leyte, only a few miles away from General Kruger, but he never interfered. He never interfered. I mean, we have this, this obsession that somehow because of information technologies, somehow somebody who is in central command might know situation better than the person who is in the caves of Afghanistan. And that's just not true. You know, you have to trust your person on the scene who should know better than anybody else, you know.
Does that get more important or does it maybe get less important when you're talking about, combat in the littorals or in close seas?
I think it's
seas?
More important, you know. The one thing, I will tell you what we need to change. We have never done that. During the wars of German unification, you know, General Moltke, he's the one who actually revived that decentralized, what we call later, Auftragstaktik. And he came to a conclusion, despite the existence of telegraph, that he possibly cannot know more about situation of the army and army corps commander far away. So he issued then instructions, what we call Weisungen. And instructions were very broadly worded things for 1 week or 2 weeks at a time. And that was the way how they commanded large forces. And then Befehle, or what they call the orders, were issued for the, you know, the lower commands. But when they wrote the intent, there was one intent which was called general intent for the force as a whole. And that intent included actually that also the purpose, you know, in other words, the method, how he wants to achieve something. But then another part of the intent was for subordinates, well, that was not included. That means it was left to the subordinate commander to decide which method to use to achieve that intent, you know. Intent is de facto what we call a military end state, you know, what the commander wants to see at the end of the mission in military terms in a certain area.
One of the things that struck me when you were talking about sea denial is that it can be a lot of little tactical actions, and that's sometimes the focus of effort, but that they can often be uncoordinated. And I thought that was really interesting because usually I think of you want coordination and you want combined arms and you want to achieve greater effects. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about why that is.
Well, you know, throughout the sea denial, you know, the major naval operations, whether defensive or offensives, are relatively rare. You know, when you have sea control, the impression sometimes that everything you do is by planning, executing major naval operations. Well, that's not the case because you have only few situations where you can have enemy forces massed in such a large number that you can destroy them, you know, and achieve some operational objective. For most of the war, as you know, is a combination of the decisive warfare and weakening enemy forces over time, what we call attrition. And I would say that in terms of the, I mean, today, that opportunities for the weaker enemy forces over time for weaker side are greater than they were in the past, because they also might certainly have in their inventories the long range, highly precise missiles, you know, and even aircraft. And so they can inflict larger losses, you know, certainly their ability to do more than the superior, I mean, stronger side are not as great, but they're greater than they were in the past, you know. So that means the smaller tactical actions at sea aim to weaken enemy force over time. That's one way of conducting sea denial. Another one is a destruction of the enemy maritime trade, and also defense of your own trade, and also defense of the coast. So almost throughout, I mean, the entire spectrum, you're going to conduct tactical actions and very rarely the major operations. Maybe if you have, for example, amphibious defense, that's might be a major operation in defense of the coast.
You know, you use the word attrition, and that's always been really interesting to me to read in your work, because, you know, in the Marine Corps, we talk maneuver warfare and everything's, you know, you don't do attrition, you don't do attrition, you don't do attrition. And then as, you know, we're shifting to think more about expeditionary advanced base operations and sea denial, all of a sudden, you know, we're reading that maybe attrition is something
that's a different,
that
you
want to do.
any navy or army or ground force should always avoid attrition at operational strategic level. That's where the danger is. But you will never avoid on force encounters at tactical level. What we have to take care of that doesn't go all the way to operational strategic level, like we had a war in Iran, Iraq in 1980 and 1988, and both sides suffered a great deal of casualties, or Western Front in 1940, 1918. I mean, this is what we have to avoid. But there is no way to avoid attrition, or what we call attrition, you know, at tactical level.
So it's fair to say that in sea denial, you're looking for attrition at the tactical level, but you still don't want attrition at the operational level.
Not operational level, yeah.
Okay.
Because a weaker side will never be able to recover. Even the stronger side would not have the time to recover from these losses, you know. So even if you have a great superiority in terms of numbers, you know, you should not really, lose a lot of ships, you know, and planes and submarines and so on. You should try to avoid that, you know.
That makes a lot of sense. And
I'm saying that the war is always a combination of weakening enemy forces over time and decisive warfare, or what we call maneuver warfare. And ideally, yeah, everything should be decisive, but you will not have a cooperative enemy that will allow you to destroy large part of his forces, you know, in a short time, you know. Okay. You know, that's decisive. My decisive operations are really what we call major naval operations, major naval joint operations, predominantly really initial phase of the war, where you can actually inflict large losses if you can attack with a surprise, you know, and destroy a large part of the fleet. And today's environment, you know, that will take, you know, destroying the forces in coastal waters and ports, you know. But now, because of the rise of China, we might be moving back to the open ocean. So if they have a large number of carriers, for example, then you will have a move, you know, to destroy these forces at sea.
Milan, so you mentioned kind of the rise of China, and obviously that's like this kind of background context for all conversations about naval, for a lot of conversations about naval warfare now. And I was just wondering how you see the United States Navy responding to the rise of the Chinese Navy, and then also, you know, might even say kind of a resurgent Russian fleet.
Well, I would say that we should take them seriously. That we should never underestimate either them or anybody else. That's history is always very, very clear on that. That the worst thing you can do is underestimate your opponent. And I read a number of times some leading officials say how the Chinese Navy doesn't have a combat experience. Well, we don't have combat experience either since Korea. Okay, we don't have any experience in fighting our peak competitor. So we really don't know how they're going to perform. I'm not saying that Chinese are 10 feet tall, but, you know, you look, you know, German Navy didn't have any experience in 1914, and they performed very well in many cases, you know, against the Royal Navy. So these kinds of things, in other words, first step is to take them seriously. And I think the second, I think we need to be more flexible how we are going to deal in terms of naval warfare. That means sea control, yes, but also sea denial. Okay. And I think we have to focus, you know, on somehow trying to balance our Navy to respond to the variety of challenges, you know, in an area we might be forced to fight.
In your mind, what would a more balanced Navy look like for the U.S. Navy?
Well, I would say the LCS, littoral combat ship, I have been always critic. I think is too big and is not really a platform for littorals. I would say we had, in my view, a lot of good designs by French and Germans and Italians, and we were able to buy it, you know, build a home here and a balanced Navy, but having a smaller platform, so, you know, less than 15 to 100 to 2,000 tons and so on. And we really have a shortage of the frigates and corvettes. And I would say the Navy should also buy conventional submarines, not to replace nuclear power submarines, but to supplement, because many of these submarines are highly effective in littoral waters, you know. And I think we need some of the organizational, I think, changes in or like organizing littoral combat groups, you know, where the smaller ships will be used, you know, in littorals, you know, but being provided with the protection beyond the horizon with the carrier strike groups, land-based air, and so on. I think we need also, how I see it, you know, proper doctrine. You know, our doctrine is not adequate in my judgment. NWP 1, naval warfare is not the, what I would call sound doctrine for the operational level of war.
So how would you recommend that the United States changes its doctrine? I mean, what changes would you want to make?
First and foremost, you know, you have to always provide strategic framework, you know, because Navy doesn't fight alone. Among other things, you have to focus properly. That capstone document should dictate, you know, the NWPs, you know, tactical pups. It must provide a proper framework for the sea control and methods, how we are going to achieve the sea denial and how methods to achieve exercising sea control. And that must always include support of other services, the Marines, which is a Navy service, Army, and land-based air. And there is not now. You need the other services can help Navy in fighting sea control or sea denial exercising. And this is now missing. I don't see any mentioning actually of other services, you know. That's a big omission. It's not a small omission.
Well, I think the Marine Corps is certainly moving that way, but you know they're not so so distant from the Navy already.
Yeah. And then we need, you know, maritime trade warfare. You know that's an integral part of the naval warfare as a whole. That has to be also. We always talk about naval control of shipping, but that's organizational stuff. You know, you need to have a concept, you know, of how to protect and defend maritime trade and also how to attack enemy maritime trade, you know. So
what other authors or books would you recommend about naval operations and naval strategy, you know, to kind of contrast with your own viewpoints?
Well, later, Colin Gray, he wrote a number of the books on strategy, including the maritime aspects, and then Jeffrey Till. And I think Jan Spiller on the naval warfare. So two, three people, you know, that currently, recently alive. I'm great admirer of Herbert Richmond, the admiral who lived in the 1930s. And he wrote a number of good books, you know, certain good classics. I always recommend classics, whether we agree or disagree, Mahan and Julian Corbett and Philip Colomb, you know, they should be all read, you know. Okay. And then also, in terms of littoral warfare, I think one of the great thinkers in my journey was, you know, Raoul Castex. He wrote the 6 volumes strategic theories, you know. And they are unfortunately not translated. They had one book published by the Naval Institute about selected parts of that. And there were some parts translated by the students here in 1930s, but that book had been widely read and believed in the Eastern Europe, in the Soviet Union, for example. So Raoul Castex is one of the great thinkers, actually, especially in terms of internal warfare.
No, I actually have a copy of Raoul Castex on my bedside table, and it's dense. So I'm working through it, but slowly. And then another, I don't know if you had ever collaborated, but the late Wayne Hughes from the Naval Postgraduate
School. Wayne Hughes, yeah, but he wrote Tactics, you know. He wrote Tactics, you know, and talking about more on operational stuff, you know.
Before I go, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of leave us with any closing comments and then tell us what you're working on and then if we can find you online anywhere.
Well, I don't know. I'm working now very hard to finish by October, I think, the Tactics on Naval Combat Arms for the Naval Institute, the sequel to the Journal of Naval Tactics. And I have already a second project, the Tactics of Combined Arms, which deals with the anti-surface warfare, anti-air warfare, mine warfare, amphibious warfare, things like that. And that should follow next year. So hope to finish this trilogy by the end of next year. So
I'd like to thank my guest today, Dr. Milan Vigo, the professor at the United States Naval War College, for joining us today. And we're going to make sure that we post links to his recent books below the podcast and some of his recent articles. Thank you for joining us. Take care.
Okay. Thank you.